Good morning. I hope everybody had a good weekend. I know yesterday Brother Gene Edmonds' funeral was held. It was exhausting, to say the least. Lasted a little over 2 hours just for the service part. Then the graveside was didn't last very long, the actual goings-on with praying and talking, but people stayed out there a long time. I went to Macaroni Grill last night to celebrate the birthday of a young guy that I guess I started being his big buddy back when he was about 14 or 15 years old. I went and preached somewhere. For whatever reason, he said, that guy's odd looking and I need to be his friend. I don't know, but good old Eddie. Eddie suffers from mild autism. He's just a good kid. He's 30 now. He's not a kid anymore. But when he has a birthday party, even though he's turning 30, you know, it's about like somebody 15 having a birthday. You know, it's a big deal for him. So you say, why are you saying all that? I said, I'm exhausted is what I'm saying. That's why I'm saying all that. I feel like I have been beaten up and thrown out and then dragged back in. So hopefully before too long, I'll feel some of the energy come back, the little that I generally carry around with me. But we are discussing the seven signs in the book of John. And I have taught John on numerous occasions. I can remember at least once going through it verse by verse years ago. And in meeting situations, I've overviewed it on a number of occasions, maybe two or three times. It's always been one of my favorite books to read, just generally. It may be my favorite gospel account, if it's possible to have one, although generally the one I'm studying at the moment becomes my favorite one, but I tend to come back to John. And I had been aware for a long time that John chapter 20, verses 30 and 31 represent the thesis of the book. Truly, Jesus did many other signs in the presence of his disciples, which are not written in this book, but these are written that you may believe that Jesus is the Christ, the Son of God, and in believing, have life in his name. So, like I said, I've been aware of that. But studying these seven signs alone, that has really struck me this time around, maybe more so than it has in the past, but it really does describe why Jesus did what he did and what was trying to be accomplished. So, here's what we've seen thusly so far. Talked about the turning of the water to wine, John chapter 2, verses 1 to 12. Jesus is the life of the party. He is master of quality. He only provides the best. Talked about the healing of the nobleman's son. Jesus is the long-distance operator. He healed a man that was some 20 miles away. Healing of the lame man. Jesus is hope for the hopeless. And then last week we talked about the feeding of the 5,000, where we see Jesus as master of quantity. He can take something very small, something that seems very insignificant. He can take a life that some might have discounted, and he can make it great. So this week, now, we've come to chapter 6, verses 15 through 21, where we'll talk about Jesus walking on the water. And this is found in all of the accounts except for Luke. And so it's necessary, really, to some degree, to look at all three accounts. I don't think I'll rush through this. I always feel this nagging need to finish whatever I've started in one class. Maybe it's being at preacher training school for so many years and you only have so much time. You place things in quadrants and try to figure out, okay, I got to cover this today, and if I don't cover it, I'm really going to be in trouble. I think I drag that with me wherever I go. So I'll try not to rush through this today because I want us to really think about it. So walking on the water, if the Lord wills, and all of that good stuff will eventually close this out with healing of the blind man in chapter 9, the raising of Lazarus in chapter 11, which, of course, are already familiar to us because we study the I Am statements. Man born blind, I am the light of the world. Resurrection of Lazarus, the raising him from the dead, I am the resurrection of the life. And so those will be a little more familiar to us when we get there. So again, looking at this, Jesus is better in the boat. And I got these little clever quips from a study that I've gone through online about these. And I like that, though. Jesus is better in the boat. We'll see why here in just a second. So this morning, John chapter 6, verses 16 through 21, the walking on the water. The walking on the water. And just, sort of open it up and get our minds, the juices therein flowing. When you think of Jesus walking on the water, would you say this is an event in the gospel accounts that you're familiar with? Maybe more so than some of the others? Is it one that you can remember maybe going to Bible school as a kid and hearing quite a bit about it? Is it one that maybe you've thought about to some degree over and against maybe some other things? You know, in 1966 in India, yes, thank you very much. I could tell it was dying, so I just thought, let's just keep on going. In 1966, there was an Indian guru holy man, this true story, who believed that he could walk on water. And I'm not making this up. There's no punchline. There's no joke coming if you're thinking, okay, he's setting this up for a joke. But there was a big gathering of people, and it was quite an event. And this man was going to demonstrate that he could do it. And you know what happened, right? Bloop. I mean, he took one step. He had all of his robes on and everything. He walked out, and he just went right to the bottom. And he came up, and he got out, and he pointed the finger to everybody, and he said, somebody here doesn't believe. I might have pointed back, maybe it's you. No, I don't know. But that's a true story. His name was Rao the Holy Man, Rao or something like that, but goes back a little way. So now, let's think about the event itself. The gospel record. You know, there are illusionists who can do that now, but it takes a lot of time and a lot of props and a lot of work. Jesus didn't need any of those things, and we'll look at that. So let's look at the record, the gospel record, and look at the various passages that show this event. Then we'll come back to John. I think, again, they all tell us something a little different, and I think it's good to do that. So let's hold our spot at John 6, and let's turn over to Matthew chapter 14. And I probably preached on this from Matthew 14 more so than any of the other accounts. But verse 22 beginning, Matthew chapter 14. And I think this is the most well-known because, we'll read it and you tell me why you think it's the most well-known. Matthew 14:22. Text says, immediately Jesus made his disciples get into the boat and go before him to the other side. Remember, he had just he just fed the 5,000, right? While he sent the multitudes away. And when he had sent the multitudes away, he went up on a mountain by himself to pray. Now that's highlighted in my Bible. He's fed the 5,000, he needs some time away. He needs some peace, so he goes up on the mountain, and as he naturally would do, his custom, he spends that time in prayer. Now, when evening came, he was alone there. But the boat was now in the middle of the sea, and commentators calculate this, and they've probably been rowing at this time maybe 3 or 4 hours. So think about that. And they covered, some think more. I've even read up to 9 hours. It's a lot of factors in how they determine it, but they've gone probably 3 or 4 miles. They're struggling at this, and these are men who are accustomed to the sea. Okay, these are familiar waters. Why would we say that? What about Peter, James, and John? What do they do? They're fishermen. So they're not unaccustomed to this kind of thing. Verse 24 says, But the boat was now in the middle of the sea, tossed by the waves, for the wind was contrary. Now in the fourth watch of the night, Jesus went to them, walking on the sea. That's between 3 and 6 in the morning. And when the disciples saw him walking on the sea, they were troubled, saying, "It is a ghost." And they cried out with fear. But immediately Jesus spoke to them, saying, "Be of good cheer, it is I, do not be afraid." We might not realize it, but the "it is I" there is the ego me, it is the I am. The translators don't generally include it because it sounds bulky in English, but it's again, there's that I am idea. Be of good cheer, it is I, do not be afraid. And Peter answered him and said, Lord, if it is you, command me to come to you on the water. So he said to him, come. And when Peter had come down out of the boat, he walked on the water to go to Jesus. But when he saw that the wind was boisterous, he was afraid, and beginning to sink, he cried out, saying, Lord, save me. And immediately Jesus stretched out his hand and caught him and said to him, oh, you of little faith, why did you doubt? And when they got into the boat, the wind ceased. Then those who were in the boat came and worshipped him, saying, truly you are the Son of God. Now there's something about this account that we don't read in the others, and it's rather obvious if we'd already read them. Anybody know what it is? Yeah, the others, this is the only time we read of Peter walking on the water. And I think this is probably the most popular account because of that. So here's some things to mark as you look at, as you think about Matthew's account. Jesus is praying on the mountain. Does he know where the disciples are? Yeah, he sent them before. Do you think he was already aware of what was going to happen? Sure he was. So mark that. Then also consider the very end of the section, where after all of this transpires, the walking on the water, the ceasing of the winds and the waves, what do? They worship him. Okay, now, that may just pass us by, but we're talking about Jews here, okay? Jewish people in the first century. You study your Old Testaments, you'll find that once Israel became a monarchy, particularly once the time of the divided kingdom took place, God's people struggled mightily with idolatry. In fact, one of the reasons that they were sent into exile, the reason that they were scattered among all the nations, was because, in one of the expressions often used, they played the harlots with the gods of the nations round about them. They were unfaithful to God. What they tried to do was hedge their bets. You say, what do you mean? I'll give you an example of hedging your bets. In Ghana, witchcraft is still very much a well-known, well-practiced, what I mean are occultic arts. I'm not talking about, you know, cold and trouble, all that kind of stuff. But there are medicine men and shaman-type individuals that live in these villages, and they're considered to be very powerful, and they can cast spells, and they can cure diseases and all this kind of thing. And let's just say that if your daughter or your son is sick and they're small, one of the things that you might have heard all your life, if you'll go see the medicine man, if you'll go see the witch, then he or she has a particular potion that he or she can say some words over it. If you'll take it and put it under the bed of your child will get better. And maybe through the years, having seen that over and over again, they've maybe seen some people get better. Even though they've now embraced Christianity, what do you think they do when their kids get sick? They go and they purchase that, thinking that, you know, yes, I believe in God. Yes, I believe he's sovereign. Yes, I believe he can heal. But, you know, maybe I better go and, you know, take care of it over here just in case, sort of. Yeah. And I was just going to bring this up because we often think that the Israelites, in a wholesale way, just quit Jehovah. That's not what they did. Jehovah just became that was their God, but when they thought it might help them to pay a little homage to another one, they would, like Baal in particular. Why so much trouble with Baal? Baal was the god of fertility. What does that mean? Well, if you can't have a baby, if your womb is barren, then go offer to Baal. If you're worried that your crops aren't going to grow, go offer to Baal. If you want more livestock, go offer to Baal, god of fertility. So, and God says, you're being unfaithful to me. You're out playing the harlot. Spiritual adultery. You're seeing other people. And we're married. We're joined together. So, we have to keep that in mind. Now, that was a long way to get back to here. By the time of the first century, after exile, after captivity, there's one thing you never read about anymore as it pertains to the sins of the Jews. And you know what that is? Idolatry. Exile, captivity, kicked idolatry out of them. They never. In fact, they were so solid about there is but one God and to Him only. You know, you shall pay your own. Now, I say all that. You say, why do you say all that? Well, I'm tired. My head's spinning. I don't really know what's going on. And I'm just kind of... What about these first century Jews worshiping a man? Let that sink in for a second. They worshiped him. They worshiped him. There was only one thing imaginable that would cause them to do that. They saw the one God manifest in the flesh based on these kinds of things. That's one of the strongest evidences for the deity of Christ, is that any Jew would ever accept him as God. They just didn't do that. You just don't do that. I mean, if somebody strolled in our assembly and said, you know, you've been told all this time there's just one God, but there's actually two. Now, there weren't two gods when it comes to Christ, but that would, our reaction and our, that how that hits us is how it would have hit any Jew. There was only one God to worship. What are they doing? They're worshiping Him. What were the signs for? Particularly in John, but it's true across the board. To show that Jesus is the Christ, the Son of God. If you're the Son of God, that means that you possess deity. If I said, you know, here comes my girl, daughter of human. What does that make her? She's a human. She's not me, but she evidently possesses the same nature that I do, and there's but one human nature. Jesus possessed the nature of deity. Now think about this. We're all sons of God and daughters. What does that mean? We now partake of the divine nature. We're not gods. But now we, because we've been born again, we have this eternal quality about us. But again, all of that's a long way to go to get to there. I just want to bring that up. I thought that'd be helpful. That's true. But that then, I just got canceled out here by a little finger. Just went black on me. Anyway. You're right, but when we read these accounts of these events, these miraculous signs, we can't really put our feet into their sandals and understand how life-changing and overwhelming and unbelievably magnificent what they saw was. I mean, we read it and it's just like reading Gulliver's Travels, man. I mean, it's just another thing. Well, that's unique, isn't that something? That's amazing. But had you been there to see it with your eyes, your only response would have been to worship Him. Well, they're already afraid even before he gets to the boat. But yeah, all of it comes into play.
But also, you know, the rumors, that's what they said. He said, we got to stop this for all the people who left.
And one of the reasons I want to take our time, I want us to really think about what's going on here. Yeah, Roy.
I think it's easier when you say something happened than it is when you Yeah.
I like the way you used weather in two different ways and two different words just then. That was impressive, too. I like that. I really like it.
That's what's scary.
Well, here's the thing that you know, like you know, Danny talked the other night when we were going through Acts 3 and 4. You know, the Sanhedrin said an undeniable miracle is taking place. But what should that cause you to do? You know, that puzzles me to no end. But anyway, let's turn to Mark 6. And this plays important.
So strong in that, knowing that America was right, they either accepted the Son of God or the Son of the Devil.
I tell you what, if a faith healer took me to a hospital and there was a little girl in a bed and she was missing a foot and was all gnarled up by some disease, and with a word, she got up and had a foot. I'm not meeting with you people anymore. My theology's changed. And that's, you know, if it's something that's undeniable, I'm going to have to go with what I see with my eyes here, because it cannot be denied. But what we find in modern day faith healing is those healings are they never seem to turn out to be what was actually said, and then they're not even a 30-second cousin to the miracles you read about in the Bible. That's the problem.
But when the turmoil in you to try to determine that, even though you see it,
I can imagine it's great.
That it would be terrible to try to figure that out. How can I accept this and accept the Bible and what it says? I mean, I don't think it'd be just easy for me to just say, okay, I'm forgetting about all y'all
but,
belief.
Well, I bet you if somebody raised your daddy,
well, no,
and he walked, I'm trying to give something
sure.
That you, here he is, you know him, he says, it's me. Then you're like, okay, I'm done.
I'm going to have to believe that, but there's going to be some turmoil.
Well, there'll still be some turmoil.
Yeah.
And my dad, too, you know, that would be one of those things where I'd say, okay, here he is. They can't fake this. This cannot be fake. He's here. That's him. Yeah, I mean, that's enough for me. I'm not going to argue against it. Yeah.
When they were approached with the fact that he was the tomb, because they knew that the tomb was empty. They were there. And it wasn't people out on the street, it was people who knew the Jewish faith.
But the others that sing the same thing, not all of them changed.
Not all of them did.
And I think that's what I'm saying is it's sound like, well, yeah, I run under a fault for him, but yeah, I've been raised to teach that that's ceased. There's no more of that. So what's changed? Really thought that also too, and now we've got this change in it. And even though they can go back in Scripture and see that coming, chose not to. I'm sticking with that.
I'll vote for you at the next meeting. So it's. I agree.
The same as just like these Jews. It was hard for them.
I understand.
But when you saw it, then it made it easier.
Yeah, it should have been the clincher, but. They should have been aware of what he would do and who he was, and they missed it. There's no doubt about that. All right, Mark 6:45, and look at the very pay close attention to the very end. This may also explain why he did what he did, walking on the water. Why he sent them ahead of him, why he sent them ahead of him in the first place. Notice verse 45. Immediately he made his disciples get into the boat and go before him to the other side, to Bethsaida, while he sent the multitude away. And when he had sent them away, he departed to the mountain to pray. Now when evening came, the boat was in the middle of the sea, and he was alone on the land. Then he saw them straining at rowing, for the wind was against them. Now about the fourth watch of the night, he came to them walking on the sea, and would have passed them by. When they saw him walking on the sea, they supposed it was a ghost, and cried out. For they all saw him and were troubled. But immediately he talked with them and said to them, "Be of good cheer, as I do not be afraid." Then he went up into the boat to them, and the wind ceased. And they were greatly amazed in themselves beyond measure, and marveled. Now notice this last statement here. Only place we find it, but he just fed the multitudes. He'd gone up on a mountain to be by himself, and he sends his disciples ahead of him. And all of this then transpires afterwards. It says, "For they had not understood about the loaves, because their heart was hardened." All right? Flip over to John 6. John 6:15, after the feeding of the multitudes, it says, "Therefore, when Jesus perceived that they were about to come and take him by force to make him king, he departed again to the mountain by himself alone." Doesn't say anything in John's account about him praying, the others do. Question is, why is he so concerned they want to make him a king, and why would they want to? We got bread and fish that's never going to run out. We talked a little bit about this before. So evidently, the crowd doesn't quite get it, right? The multitudes don't quite get it. And then he does what he does. Again, we'll just read through this very short in John's account. It says, "Now when evening came, his disciples went down to the sea, got into the boat, and went over the sea toward Canaan," or Capernaum. "And it was already dark, and Jesus had not come to them. Then the sea arose because a great wind was blowing. So when they had rowed about 3 or 4 miles, they saw Jesus walking on the sea and drawing near the boat, and they were afraid. But he said to them, 'It is I, do not be afraid.' But they willingly received him into the boat, and immediately the boat was at the land." They were gone. Now that's an interesting idea here at the end. We'll come back to it. But the idea is this. If you put all the accounts together, and people who understand the Sea of Tiberias, which is just another term for the Sea of Galilee, that they would have been about 3 or 4 miles out from where they started. And the text will tell us as we read the accounts, they seem to be right in the middle of it. But now Jesus gets into the boat, and what happens? Immediately, they're on the land. Now, remember Philip and the Ethiopian nobleman? After he baptized him and came up out of the water, the Bible speaks of the Spirit taking him away, transporting him to another place. And we read of that same kind of thing happening even to some of the prophets. But the idea is, seems to be, the implication is, there was something miraculous even about once he got the boat, bam, they were there. Now, what would that make you, you know? I mean, that would, suddenly there's no more storm and you're standing on the bank. That's, you know, where I grew up, we'd say, "That's a thinker. That's a thinker." We wouldn't say think, we'd say think. We'd say, "That's a thinker." Yes, John. I like your thinking, but I'm of the persuasion, based on some other things, that the storm quit. In fact, not this account, but on another instance, remember when Jesus calmed the storm? He'd been asleep in the boat, Mark 6, one of those accounts. When he said, "Peace be still," and it stopped, which is, I got to run with this guy, you know. If when that happened, it said, they said something to the effect of, what manner of man is this? That even the waves and the seas obey him. Well, what manner of man is this? More than just man, right? So there's all these little sayings that, you know, we find strewn throughout the gospel accounts, all the while trying to pick up our attention and saying, look, this Jesus is who he claimed to be. I like this. It kind of summarizes the whole thing. The miracle on the sea is really four miracles in one. Jesus walks upon the sea. Without suspending the laws of gravity, he controls them in the interest of the kingdom. He caused Peter to walk on the sea, but this story is not found in the fourth gospel. He reveals himself as the master of the storm, for when he enters the boat, the storm ceases. That's not recorded in John necessarily. He conquers even space, for when he enters the boat, it is on the shore all at once. So within the framework of that, there are four things going on, all of which demand one conclusion. This guy's not like anybody else we've ever been around. Not like anybody else we've ever been around. You know, when you do your daily Bible reading or when you read a gospel account, do you find it difficult to kind of, again, really put yourself, I know we can't totally, but do you find it difficult to put yourself in their shoes trying to decipher what it must have really been like? And, you know, in our society, we've been geared, you know, we almost believe naturalism. Sometimes it affects us far beyond what it should. And all naturalism is the belief that all there is nature, natural law. And that if you are an atheist and you believe in naturalism, you basically believe that when the earth became a reality through some evolutionary process, the universe became a closed box, and within that box there are laws which will always hold true no matter what. You know, here's one. How many times do you think I can drop that and hit the floor? It's always going to hit the floor, right?
But if you're an atheist, eventually one time you'll drop it.
Yeah, that's true. I'm not atheist. And see, we live in an era, and as a people, and I think rightly so, we believe every miracle in Scripture, we believe that they all had a purpose. And when we say that they have ceased as such, we're not saying God no longer works in the world or that he can't do amazing things. We're talking about these kinds of episodes for this kind of purpose. Their purpose was served. God still heals, but it's through providence. It's through his orchestration of events, those kinds of things. Here we're talking about not the suspending of natural law, but the superseding of it. We'll say more about that as we get along. And one of the things we'll see, what happens to Peter when he looks around and he takes his eyes off Jesus? He starts to sink. Who's still standing on the sea? Water's still on the sea, Linda. That's perfect. Jesus is still standing. What does that mean? Jesus is standing, but Peter is sinking. Yeah, the law of gravity, Jesus didn't just say, okay, no more gravity for a minute. But his power was such that it was able to overcome it. Whereas he allowed the natural process of things to take place in Peter's life, and the law of gravity began to take hold. Whereas for a time, when he had his eyes on Jesus, he was able to tap in even to that superseding. The closer you walk with the Lord, yeah, the more you begin to see his thumbprint. But I was just going to say this, and John, I'll get to you just a second. Promise, I won't let time run out. But I'll forget this thought. Here's what happens. We live in an era now where we're 2,000 years from this kind of thing. And because we are, has anybody seen anybody walk on water here? You have. Okay, well, forget it. Let's just move on then. I would assume we could poll the whole group this morning and not one of us has ever seen anything like that. And some people draw the conclusion, like David Hume, the old philosopher of a couple of hundred years ago, he said, well, if something's not the norm and you never see it, then it doesn't, it just can't be true. Any of you play bridge? Anybody in here play bridge? Nobody plays bridge. You play bridge? No. It's a card game, right? The likelihood of ever enjoying a perfect hand in bridge is astronomical. Astronomical. The odds, and I don't play bridge, I'm just giving you an example. The odds of ever having a perfect hand are, I mean, it's crazy. It just doesn't happen. But guess what? It has happened. But you could most likely, you could take the whole country, the United States, everybody could play bridge every day, and you would seldom ever see a perfect hand. And here's what some people say. Well, a perfect hand then is not possible. But it is possible. Some people say, well, there's all these billions of people on the earth, and we haven't seen anything like this. Therefore, it isn't possible. But it has happened, just like the perfect bridge hand has happened. John? Stretched out his hand. I'm assuming he must have. I mean, you think about it. I doubt very seriously that he drug him like this. What do you think? Maybe he grabbed him by the belt loop like my brother did me when he was teaching me how to swim, and Peter swam back, you know. I think they walked back to that boat. I'd have to look closely. I don't know if it says it explicitly, but I think the idea is certainly there. Well, I don't know how far we're going to get. Here's some theology. We'll start with this, and then we got just a few seconds here. Theological truths. Theological truths. Okay, what do we learn from this? First of all, I want you to think about this idea here. Man, I must have grown up in Boston. This idea here. God is sovereign over the sea. What does that mean? He's in control of it, right? We'll look at just a few passages. We'll close on this note. Exodus 15. I can read it for you. You can turn there with me. I'll turn quickly. But we'll read these three passages, and I'll think they're good. Remember after the children of Israel crossed on dry land, when the Egyptian army was pursuing them, in the song of Moses, Moses penned a song about the situation. In verse 6 through 8, he said, "Your right hand, O Lord, has become righteous or glorious in power. Your right hand, O Lord, has dashed the enemy in pieces. And in the greatness of your excellence, you have overthrown those who rose against you. You set forth your wrath. It consumed them like stubble. And with the blast of your nostrils, the waters were gathered together. The flood stood upright like a heap. The depths congealed in the heart of the sea." What is that saying? By God's power, he controlled the sea. Okay? Now, I like this next one. You have to be careful when you read the book of Job, because sometimes some of the players and some of their comments are not accurate. Job 26. We'll probably come back to this, but I'll just read it quickly. Verse 12. This is what Job said of God. "He stirs up the sea with his power, and by his understanding he breaks up the storm." In other words, he causes the storm to cease. God does. What did Jesus do? He caused the storm to cease. Then in Psalm 33, verse 7, text says, verse 6, starting by the word of the Lord, the heavens were made, and all the hosts of them by the breath of his mouth. He gathers the waters of the sea together as a heap. He lays up the deep in storehouse. And I like this one. What does that say? The sea is his. So if a fella comes along and he can manipulate and control the sea and the weather, what does that tend to say? What would it have said to the Jewish mind? And what are these signs for? To show and to prove that Jesus Christ is the Son of God. See the little signals as you move through? When Jesus did these things, see how their minds would have flooded back to this kind of a deal? Anyway, that's all we can stand. We can't stand no more. Popeye used to say. I do a pretty good Popeye imitation, but I won't do it.